the narrow hallways and the cramped dorm rooms of Jester Hall. The crowds pressed in on him. Even the auditorium classes were too small. He couldn't concentrate on lessons. He watched the ceiling, sure it was going to cave in and bury him alive. He would long for home, the ranch back in Del Rio, where he'd never had any problem with small places and crowds. But he couldn't go back home. His father would never allow it. And so he found other ways to cope, and that had led him to Chase and Markey. "What do we do now?" Markey asked. Chase picked up an empty tequila bottle from the dresser. "We try again." "It's gonna be hard," Markey said. "We've got no choice, unless you want to end up like Chris." Markey's face paled. "Bastard deserved it, after the shit he tried to pull." On that, at least, Ty agreed. Chris was better off dead. It was his own fault they might not make it off the island alive. God, Ty wished he'd taken the boat. He should have been faster. He shouldn't have listened to Navarre. "We'll stay low for a while," Chase decided. "But be ready. We see an opportunity, we go." Ty's stomach churned. He resented Navarre for keeping him here. He wanted to kill the guy. But at the same time, he seemed smart. He wasn't afraid of Markey or Chase. If there was a way to stop them, or make it so Ty didn't have to share their fate, Navarre might know how.
"I'm gonna be sick,"
Ty muttered. Chase looked at him with disgust. "Not in my room, you're not."
"I got my medicine next door," Ty said meekly. I'll go throw up there."
"Not now," Chase insisted. "We're going downstairs. The fucking detective wants another group meeting, and you are going to behave yourself." Ty nodded miserably. He slid off the bed and hobbled toward the door. He'd have to wait. He'd be looking for an opportunity, but not the kind Chase meant. Out in the hallway, he took a deep breath, trying to gather his courage. The walls closed in on him. But he concentrated. He could make it down the hall. It was just like the barrel of a gun. He was aiming at his target, and his target was to get free of Chase and Markey, to get off this island in one piece. If other people died, that wasn't his problem. He took a tentative step, then another. Chase and Markey walked on either side of him, but Ty promised himself he'd be rid of them by tomorrow, one way or another. Chapter 23. On my way downstairs, I thought about Alex. I wondered how he'd react to Chris Stowall's death. The booming and groaning of the storm outside made me think of the last fireworks display I'd ever seen Alex do. It hadn't exactly been a celebration. That July 4th, my mother had asked Garrett to watch me, which was never a good sign. She wasn't feeling well. She couldn't handle the company of others that night. At sunset, Garrett took me down to the beach where Alex was setting up his display. His tubes and wires looked like a miniature power plant. He'd set everything up on a length of wooden flats and was busy running around checking his fuses one more time. The other hotel guests, there were never that many, brought picnic blankets and barbecue prepared by Alex's dad. Even Delilah, the old maid, had come down to watch the show. Alex's fireworks displays were some of the only times I ever saw her smile. My brother was in an unusually good mood that night. New guests had arrived the day before, and they had a teenage daughter. Garrett had big plans to get to know her tonight. He'd combed his unruly hair, which made him look even geekier than usual, and put on fresh jeans and his Pat McGee's Surf Shop T-shirt. "You help Alex out, okay?" Garrett told me. "I'm just gonna, you know, get a soda or something." He went off in search of the new girl. I suppose I should have been relieved that he was preoccupied and happy, but I knew it just meant he'd be in a foul mood tomorrow or the next day, whenever his romantic prospects fell apart, as they inevitably would. Alex was too busy working to pay attention to me. The sky was turning purple, and the guests were starting to cheer and call for the show. Behind us, the hotel at sunset looked like a perfect haunted house. I didn't hear Mr. Eli come up behind us until he spoke.
"Are you ready, Alex?"
It was the first time I'd ever seen Mr. Eli outside. He wore his maroon bathrobe, as always. The cuffs of his pajama pants were neatly folded up to keep them out of the sand. His feet were bare, so pale that they were almost luminous in the dusk. I wondered if the old man was a vampire, coming out only after dark. But I suspected that a real vampire wouldn't look so sickly and weak. Alex brushed his hands on his pants and stood up.
"Ready, sir. About 10 minutes until full dark."
"Wonderful," Mr. Eli smiled. "Your mother would be proud, you know. She loved fireworks."
Alex looked down at the mortars. The aluminum foil had been peeled away. Shreds of it blew across the sand, glinting in the last light like pieces of metallic eggshell.
"Y'all better get clear, okay?" Alex said. "Show's gonna start."
I watched from the sand dunes. I suppose compared to professional shows, Alex's display was pretty paltry, but I thought it was fabulous. Maybe that's because I'd watched him put the whole thing together. Maybe I was just amazed that something so loud, bright, and colorful could come from a dour kid like Alex Huff. The fact that I didn't like Alex, that I feared him, in fact, made the show all the more fascinating. The wind was warm, blowing through the seagrass. Sand fleas started a 7-course meal on my legs, but I didn't want to move. The smoke was almost as interesting as the starbursts and fireballs. It made ghostly faces in the night sky, swiftly stretched by the breeze and blown to shreds.
"It gets better every year," a voice said at my shoulder. I jumped in surprise.
It was Mr. Eli, but he wasn't talking to me. He stood in the dunes with another man. Both of them were only shadowy silhouettes, the tops of their heads illuminated by bursts of fireworks.
"Know what he told me today?"
the other man asked. It was Alex's father. His voice sounded deep and sad.
"He said he wants to join the army."
Mr. Eli was silent as a triple burst of silver lit up the water over the boat dock.
"He wants to get away from here," Mr. Huff said. "I can't blame him. Nothing but bad memories."
"Do you really believe that?" Mr. Eli asked.
Alex's father sniffed. I couldn't see his face, but I could almost feel the grieving radiating from him, like the heat of a sun lamp.
"I don't know, sir. I don't mean to sound ungrateful."
"It's all right," Mr. Eli said. "Let him go if he wants to. He's got his mother's spirit. Hard to tie that down."
"Yes."
Mr. Huff's voice sounded ragged.
"Suppose it is."
Down at the beach, I caught a glimpse of Garrett and his new potential girlfriend. Garrett's crooked smile lit up blue in a burst of copper chloride light. The girl was too pretty for him. I could tell just by looking, the way she held herself apart from him. She would never fall for him.
"Alex will come back," Mr. Eli said. "Mark my words, he appreciates this place more than he lets on. If I had a son, well, I wish I had someone as good as Alex to inherit this place. He has a good heart."
I wanted to tell Mr. Eli that he was wrong. People with good hearts didn't treat younger kids the way Alex treated me. But I bit my lip and said nothing.
"Suppose he got that from his mother, too,"
Mr. Huff said gruffly.
"Sure didn't get a sense of forgiveness from me."
A series of fireballs shot in the air, yellow, green, red. They began to die and fall, only to explode into interlocking spheres, like the Venn diagrams we did in class. My English teacher's lessons forcing me to think inside the curves. How are these things alike? Where do they overlap?
"Are you sure?"
Mr. Eli began to say.
Do you think you'll ever tell him?
No, Mr. Huff said. His tone was absolutely firm.
He's bound to find out someday. South Texas is just too small a place. Everyone is connected somehow.
They never found us, Mr. Huff said.
No, Mr. Eli said. That's true. This place is separate. But if he leaves...
The old man never finished his sentence. The fireworks finale filled the sky, so bright that I could suddenly see the men's faces, and they looked down and saw me. Perhaps I should have played it cool, but in that moment, I felt too much like a trespasser. I ran down the sand dune and along the beach into the dark until the fireworks were far behind me, echoing against the side of the hotel like cannon fire.
The others were gathering in the parlor. Benjamin Lindy stood by the fireplace. Maya had come downstairs, ignoring my objections. She looked a little better. She sat on the sofa now, comforting Imelda, who was crying into her apron. Chase and Markey were arguing with Ty, who seemed to have calmed down a little. Or perhaps Markey had simply threatened to sap him over the head again. Lane took a deep breath and walked into the room. I started to follow, but Garrett pulled me aside.
"Now would be a good time, little bro, if you got something to say."
It took me a moment to realize what he was asking.
"About Lane?"
"Yeah, of course about Lane."
I shook my head. "Not really. Maybe there are some things I shouldn't have to say. But it wouldn't make much difference, would it?"
"You think I'm taking advantage of her?"
"I think she's fragile. I think you're both emotionally strung out."
"You have any idea what she's been through? You realize who her husband is?"
"That's not the point. I like her, Trace."
He rarely called me Trace. He tended to save my name for times when he was seriously pissed off or needed money.
"Garrett, the circumstances are extraordinarily bad for starting to like somebody," he grunted.
"How's that different than every other day of my life?"
"It is true?"
Imelda asked. I looked around the parlor. Alex sat on the steps with his head in his hands. Ty had crashed on the couch with an ice pack on his head. I couldn't tell if he was conscious or not. I was hoping not. Chase and Markey leaned against the pool table behind him, each with a pool cue in his hands. Benjamin Lindy stood by the kitchen door as if he were guarding the exit. Garrett, Lane, and Maya shared the other couch. Nobody looked happy to be here.
"Chris Stowall is dead," I said. "That's true."
Imelda crossed herself and murmured a Spanish prayer.
"Ty was right," Chase said. "This Calavera guy's gonna kill us all."
"He hasn't yet," I reminded him.
"Dude," Markey said, "he can't let anybody raise the alarm. He needs to get off the island.
It won't help us to panic."
Garrett snorted.
"A body in the cellar and one in the freezer, and we shouldn't panic. Thanks for the advice, little bro."
"Always nice to know your brother's on your side. Whoever the killer is," I said, "I don't think we're looking for a stranger. Chris brought Longoria to the island because he knew Calavera would be here this weekend. Calavera is probably in this room." Chase and Markey exchanged wary looks. Imelda's hands clenched on her apron.
"So why hasn't he killed the rest of us?"
Garrett asked.
"If this guy's such a cold-blooded murderer, it'd be easy to do."
"I don't think he wants to," I said. "I don't think he enjoys killing."
"Yo, little bro, tell that to Chris Stowall."
"Calavera was cornered," I said, "first by Longoria, then Chris Stowall. But I don't think he relishes the idea of murdering everyone in this room."
"If he has to," Lindy said, "he will. We don't know that."
"I'm sorry, son, I do. If you have any idea who the killer is, you need to tell us now."
Alex stood suddenly, as if Benjamin Lindy had just slipped ice down his back.
"And what will you do about it, old man? Start killing the suspects?"
"Alex," I said, "you want to say something?" He looked around at all of us, like our presence horrified him. Then he took a shaky breath.
"Garrett?"
"Yeah, man."
"Here."
Alex handed him an envelope, beige hotel stationery, like the one that had been slipped under my door.
"In case something happens."
"Nothing's gonna happen, man. It's okay. In case it does,
keep charge of that, okay? Don't read it, unless..."
"Whoa, man, I told you." But Alex raised his hands to block Garrett's words and stormed out of the room. I stood in uncomfortable silence, everyone's eyes on me. I felt like I was back in front of my English class at UTSA. I just assigned an unpopular essay on Chaucer's use of dirty jokes, and the class was about to rebel. The only difference was that in most of my classes, the students weren't armed.
"We should stay in here for what's left of the night," I suggested. "Safety in numbers."
"All right," Lane said. Garrett looked unhappy. I had a feeling he had other plans about where to spend the night, and they didn't involve anyone but Lane.
"What about Mr. Huff?" Lindy asked.
I looked at the doorway. I wasn't sure how to explain Alex's sudden exit.
"I'll talk to him." I turned to Imelda. "¿Y dónde está José?"
It was the first time I'd spoken Spanish to her. I could see her doing a quick mental rewind, trying to figure out if she'd said anything embarrassing around me in Español.
"Upstairs, señor. The news about Señor Stowall."
"I'll find him, too.
Garrett, you and Mr. Lindy try to keep everybody else together."
"I don't have a gun," Garrett complained. "He's got a gun."
I handed him Maya's .357. "Now you have a gun." It must have been a Texas thing. Two pistols in the room made me feel easier than just one. I turned and headed out the way Alex had gone. At the end of the third-floor hallway, light leaked through an open doorway. I peeked inside and found Jose sitting on a bed. It was raining inside the room. The ceiling drizzled and sagged. It looked more like a washcloth than sheetrock. The room smelled of marigolds and limes. In one corner was a little altar, covered with a turquoise shawl. It held a statue of the Virgin of Guadalupe and a few framed photographs, probably Jose and Imelda's dead relatives. A row of candles sputtered and flickered. The bedspread was soaked. Everything was soaked. But Jose just sat there, holding his flashlight, watching the candles die one after the other. "Jose." It took him a second to focus on me.
"The attic. I think the roof above us is gone."
"Do you know where Alex is?" His eye twitched.
"No, senor."
"Your things are getting ruined. Do you want help covering them?" Jose's flashlight beam traced a figure eight on the soggy carpet.
"There is not enough tarp in the whole house, senor. God's will. What he keeps or destroys."
I approached the altar. Among the photos of the honored dead, one showed Jose and Imelda, 10 or 15 years younger, each of them holding a baby.
"Your children," I guessed.
"Twins?" He nodded.
"How did they die?"
He looked up, anger flaring in his eyes. We were suddenly man to man. No subservience, no careful deference.
"I don't talk about that."
"Translation, none of your damn business, senor." A trickle of rain spattered on my back. The drops against the damp carpet sounded like kisses. "Chris Stowall was in the freezer for hours," I said. "You didn't have any reason to go in there when you prepared dinner?"
"No, senor."
"Who else goes into the kitchen usually?"
"I didn't kill him, senor."
There was an odd tone to his voice, almost like regret. "You said you'd heard of Calavera before. Was it only from the news?" Jose's nails bit into the palm of his hand.
"That man, Senor Brazos, when he came here..."
"Wait a minute. Peter Brazos came here?"
"In November. He talked to Senor Huff."
"Why didn't you mention this before?"
It is not my place, senor. The man stayed for only a few hours. He asked questions and left. At the time, I did not think he talked to you.
Poco.
He asked how long we knew Senor Hoff. He mentioned names. I did not know. Showed me photographs of some men and asked if I had seen them.
The drug bosses he was prosecuting.
No sé, senor. Perhaps.
On the altar, a raindrop hit a candle, and it fizzled out. In the old photograph, the faces of Jose, Imelda, and their children flickered. I didn't like Jose's story about Peter Brazos. I especially didn't like that Alex never mentioned the visit. He'd pretended to know nothing about Brazos or the murder of his family.
Senor, I'm sorry you came here, Jose said. You and your wife.
I tried for a reassuring smile. I'm not sure I pulled it off very well.
By tomorrow the storm should pass. With any luck, a boat will come. We'll all be able to leave.
Yes.
Alex wants to sell the hotel. What will you and Imelda do? He stared at me, as if the future tense meant nothing to him.
What can we do, senor? Mr. Hoff gave us a home here. This is all we have.
The contents of a room, a few photos and candles, a turquoise shawl, and some Mexican blankets, all ruined by the rain.
6 months ago, Calavera killed a woman and her two young daughters, I said.
I don't think he planned to do that. I think killing them shook him up so much that he started to think about retiring, possibly even making amends.
Anyone who kills children, his soul is lost, Jose said. There are no amends.
We need to stay together, I told him. We'll all sleep in the parlor.
I have to check the basement first. Mr. Hoff,
he hesitated.
Mr. Hoff said it was flooding.
Doesn't it bother you that there's a body down there?
Jose gave me a look I couldn't quite read.
I thought he might be about to tell me something.
Then he rose and left the room, leaving me alone with the rain and the scent of extinguished candles.
I had no luck finding Alex. Maybe because I was sidetracked.
Somehow I got turned around on the first floor, running into a dead end where Alex had closed off the collapsed room, then heading back.
Yes, it's true. Despite being a former sleuth, my sense of direction is sadly lacking.
Maya has a great deal of fun reminding me of this whenever we're lost on the highway. I found a bedroom door ajar and figured it would do no harm to knock. No answer. Natural curiosity, I looked in. After getting used to wreckage and chaos, I was a little shocked to find a completely neat room. The bedspread was folded down. An old-fashioned brown leather suitcase sat on the chair. One navy blue suit and a dress shirt hung in the closet. On the dresser lay a leather notebook, a ballpoint pen, and a box of .45 ammunition. Benjamin Lindy's room. Either that, or I had seriously misjudged the college guys. Under normal circumstances, I would have backed out.
Well, okay, perhaps not. But at least I would have hesitated, pondering whether or not I should invade Mr. Lindy's privacy. As it was, I went right in and opened the notebook.
He was a lawyer, all right. Everything was documented, neatly organized, dated, and labeled, even though it appeared to be a personal scrapbook. The first thing inside was a studio portrait of a woman in her early 40s, a little older than me, maybe my brother's age. She had short blonde hair and green eyes. Her sharp nose and the determined angle of her jaw reminded me very much of Benjamin Lindy. She had his wry smile, too, though on a beautiful woman, the effect was quite different than on an old gentleman. Her name was printed at the bottom of the photo. Rachel Brazos. The date? Last Christmas. The next page? A letter Rachel had written to her father. She asked whether the family ranch had gotten any rain. She invited her father to visit in Corpus Christi. She wrote about the tiles she had chosen for her kitchen remodeling. A play her two little girls had performed in school,
She signed the note XOX Ray. Nothing consequential. The letter was dated about a month before the photo was taken. Some pictures of the two Brassos girls followed. Halloween. School picture day. I flipped through them quickly. They were painful to look at. There were some news clippings about Rachel's career at a local law firm, following in her father's footsteps. One article recounted a criminal case she'd worked in conjunction with the district attorney's office. Apparently, that's how she met her future husband, Peter Brassos. Rachel's successful legal career had been put on hold. Relatively late, she decided to become a wife and mother. Like Maya. A little too much like Maya. I kept turning pages. A few years farther back in time, one picture was labeled Rachel Lindy, graduation, Texas A&M. Her hair was longer, swept over one shoulder. Her eyes gleamed with humor and confidence. Next page, a poem by Rachel Lindy, clipped from a college anthology. The poem wasn't very good. It described a storm. I didn't want to read about storms. Another letter from Rachel to her father. Judging from the date, Rachel would have been about 22. She promised to visit over Thanksgiving. She gently chastised her dad for asking about who she might be dating. Nothing serious, Dad. He would have to be as good as you, right? Guys like that are scarce. The oldest clipping was about Rachel's swim team in high school. Nothing earlier than that. Nothing from her childhood. No pictures of Rachel with her parents. I flipped back to the most recent photograph of Rachel. Even without knowing her background, I would have guessed she was married with kids. The humor in her eyes was tinged with a kind of weary satisfaction, the look of a new mother who had a family counting on her.
Finding what you want.
Benjamin Lindy was standing in the doorway. Your daughter, I said. Lindy walked to the bed. He sat down stiffly, then folded his hands.
Yes. Rachel and your two granddaughters were killed in that explosion. I'm sorry.
In the dim glow of my flashlight, Lindy's eyes glittered.
I'm done with sympathy, son.
You were friends with Jesse Longoria.
I told you. I asked his advice once. After that, we saw each other professionally a few times. I wouldn't call him a friend. Then his supervisor, Barry, started communicating with that evil man.
Calavera wanted to make a deal.
He wanted to trade information for a new identity. Barry was helping negotiate his surrender when Marshal Longoria found out he did not approve.
Longoria tipped you off to what was happening.
On the contrary, I notified him what his boss was up to.
How did you find out?
Chris Stowall.
You knew Stowall?
No. I'd never heard of Mr. Stowall until he called. He told me he knew who killed my daughter. He told me the killer was trying to make a deal with the Marshal's Service to escape justice. I was incredulous. I contacted Longoria, and he was able to confirm the negotiations. Between us, we decided we could not let that happen.
How did Chris know to contact you? Why wouldn't he just tell the police if he knew something?
Greed, sir. Lindy answered. Mr. Stowall wanted money for his information.
And he knew you wouldn't go to the police?
How?
Lindy hesitated.
This whole area is a close-knit community, Mr. Navarre. Most people have heard of me. Rachel's death was in all the media. I made no secret of my desire for revenge when she and her girls were murdered. I was quite vocal about the police's failure to apprehend Calavera. I assume Chris Stowall knew all this. How much did he want? $50,000. Nothing, really.
You'd already paid him $20,000.
You mean the money you found in the duffel bag?
Lindy shook his head.
I don't know where Stowall got that money. I hadn't paid him a dime. I didn't intend to until we found Calavera.
I thought about the entries in Chris Stowall's journal, the cryptic references to how much he needed money, and the suggestion that Lane had been encouraging him to leave behind his past shady dealings.
Apparently, Stowall had other money-making schemes besides providing revenge opportunities to bitter old men. Chris promised Calavera would be here this weekend, I said. He sent Longoria a business card with the date, June 5th.
Yes, Lindy said.
Somehow he found an email from Calavera to the Marshal Service. Did Chris tell you anything else? Anything that hinted who Calavera was? Hotel employee, guest?
Very little, Mr. Navarre. He brought us here. He promised irrefutable proof. He said...
Yes? Lindy tapped a finger thoughtfully on the top of his ammunition box.
He assumed I knew Rebel Island. He said I should have reason to hate this place.
Do you? He hesitated a little too long.
No. Perhaps he simply meant this is where I would find my daughter's killer. That's why I should hate the place.
I looked down at the scrapbook. The picture of Rachel Brassus. She looked happy with her family and her life. She'd had every reason to expect many more years with her husband, watching their two daughters grow up. Mr. Lindy, once you find Calavera, what do you intend to do? The old man looked gaunt and hungry. Despite his formal clothes, his clipped gray hair, his grandfatherly manner, he reminded me suddenly of heroin addicts I'd known. Polite, friendly, until you withheld what they wanted.
Son, I know what happens in the legal system. You do too. My daughter's death will go unpunished, because that's a lesser evil when weighed against catching Calavera's employers. I can't allow that.
You can't just kill him.
How many has Calavera killed?
Give me your gun, I told him. He shook his head. Give it to me, I repeated, or I'll take it away. His face flushed, but I held his eyes. I could take the gun. I had no doubt, and I let him see that.
Lindy opted for the dignified solution. He took out his .45 and gave it to me. I ejected the clip, slipped it and the gun into my pockets. I took his box of ammunition.
Son, you're making a mistake.
Suddenly the electric lights flickered on. Somewhere in the distance my brother's muffled voice yelled, "Yes!"
Music cranked into gear. The steel drums of Margaritaville wafted down the hallway.
"No!" Garrett shouted. "Not that song! Kill it!"
I sighed. The way Garrett hated that song, I figured I'd better get back before we had another homicidal maniac on our hands. I left Mr. Lindy sitting on his bed, staring at the scrapbook of his dead daughter's life. Chapter 24. The day Alex got out of the army, he found himself on the streets of San Antonio with no plans, no home, and not much money. He drove out of the gates of Fort Sam Houston, bought a six-pack of beer at the nearest convenience store, and meandered down Broadway to the Witt Museum. He sat on the banks of the San Pedro Creek, watching the geese glide by in the green water. Huge live oaks cast mottled shadows on the grass. Alex's eyes still hadn't adjusted from the harsh sunlight of Kuwait. He felt like he had sand in his boots, and not the good kind of sand from the Texas beaches. Desert sand, fine, dry, and all-pervasive, from a world of unrelenting heat. He took out his father's knife and ran his finger down the blade. He imagined himself walking on the edge. Today, he had to decide. After 4 years of letting the army tell him what to do, where to go, when to eat, how to dress, he had to make choices again, and that scared him. Finally, he pulled out his address book. He hadn't used it in months. Most of the numbers belonged to friends who had died or girlfriends who'd left him. He walked to a payphone at the corner of Broadway and called Garrett. He got an answer immediately. Garrett was in town, it turned out, visiting his brother Trace.
"I'll meet you at the Liberty Bar," he said. "Give me 30 minutes.
"You bringing Trace?" Garrett laughed.
"You think I should?"
Alex hung up. 33 minutes later, Alex arrived at the Liberty Bar.
The two-story whitewashed building hadn't changed in decades. It was famously slanted like a carnival funhouse with a balcony around the second floor. Inside, the hardwood floor creaked under the waiter's feet, and the leaning walls made Alex feel like he was in the belly of a ship. Liquor bottles gleamed against the bar mirror. Locals crowded the tables, tucking away pot roast sandwiches or chiles rellenos. Garrett sat near the back exit. He was already on his second shiner bock. Alex hadn't seen him in over 3 years, but when he sat down, Garrett started right into it, as if Alex had simply come back from the bathroom.
"So, I was talking to Trace today, and he's going to get a state license. Become a legitimate P.I. Can you believe that?"
Alex shook his head. He'd seen Trace a few times over the years, but it was still hard to think of him as a grown-up, much less an investigator.
"I need advice," he said.
Garrett nodded like this was the most natural request in the world, despite the fact that Alex had never once taken Garrett's advice on anything. In fact, Alex had pretty much defined himself as a teenager by doing the opposite of whatever Garrett suggested. Alex talked about his different ideas, starting a fireworks business and traveling the country, or moving to California, or... there was always Rebel Island. The name hung in the air between them. Glasses clinked at the bar, trucks rumbled by on Josephine Street. Garrett drained his beer, his eyes glinted as dangerous as sparks on kerosene.
"I could go for dinner on the island."
They left after lunch. By sunset they were on the beach, toasting the Gulf of Mexico and reminiscing. Within a week, Alex had decided to buy the hotel. Now, sitting in the dark, Alex unfolded his father's knife. Once more, he felt like he was teetering on the blade. He thought about the letter he'd given to Garrett. He hoped Garrett would understand. It wasn't much to make amends, but it was all he could do. Hopefully some of the others would be spared. Alex didn't care about himself anymore. He felt just like his hotel, battered, torn by the wind, coming apart at the joints. He stared at the candy skull on the table. He had tried to fix things. He had tried to put aside his anger. But it hadn't worked. With the edge of his knife, he flicked the skull off the table.
"Calavera," he said.
And like magic, the door to the room creaked open. Alex stood. He knew he was going to fall off the wrong side of the blade this time. Nothing would save him. Not Mr. Eli, not Garrett's advice, not even the hope that people sometimes change. They didn't. And Calavera would win. Chapter 25. I shared a sofa with Maya and Garrett while I told them about my conversations with Jose and Mr. Lindy. Lindy and most of the others were also in the parlor, but between the storm and the Jimmy Buffett music, it wasn't hard to talk without being overheard.
"Brassus visited the island," Maya said. 2 months later, his family was murdered."
"Yeah," I said.
"Why didn't Brassus come back here afterward? Did he ever follow up?"
"I don't know. If I could find Alex..."
"There's got to be a reason," Garrett insisted. "So this Brassus guy asked some questions. So what? That doesn't mean Alex, Garrett."
Alex should have said something. He didn't.
"What about this Lindy guy? How do you know he isn't Calavera?"
"It was Lindy's daughter who died," I said. "He isn't an assassin. I mean, he wants to kill somebody in cold blood, but he's not that assassin."
"Great," Garrett grumbled. "That clears it right up."
"The poor man."
Maya sipped her red raspberry leaf tea. She looked over at Lindy, who sat in conversation with Jose. Jose looked uneasy to have the old lawyer's attention.
"The poor man?" I asked Maya.
"He lost his daughter and granddaughters. How would you feel?"
"Like tracking down Calavera and butchering him. But I wouldn't do it."
She raised her eyebrows.
"Okay," I said. "I'd think about doing it, but you'd kick my butt if I did."
"Lindy has nothing left to lose," Maya said. "No family, his career is behind him. He's too old to care about jail time."
You think I should give him his gun back?
On the contrary, I think he may be more dangerous than this assassin, more unpredictable. But I also don't want to see him killed. If Calavera finds out why he's here...
I still think Lindy's nuts, Garrett said. You sure he doesn't have another gun?
I'm not sure, I admitted. And speaking of that, give me back the .357. Garrett looked offended.
I'm your brother.
A good reason for extreme caution. Gun, please. Garrett muttered a few curses, but he gave me Maya's gun. Jimmy Buffett kept singing about Key West. The time must have been well past 1 in the morning, and everybody looked even more tired than I felt. Ty was out cold from whatever medication his friends had given him. I kind of envied him. Chase and Markey were teaching Imelda to play Spit in the Ocean, which probably had some sort of cosmic significance when played in a hurricane. Lane had made herself a nest of blankets next to the wall. She was curled into a fetal position, but her eyes were wide open. Mr. Lindy was still talking to Jose, who was looking frazzled and soaked. Ceiling plaster flecked his black hair. There was no sign of Alex.
"He'll be back," Garrett said, apparently reading my mind. "He won't do anything crazy."
"I hope you're right. What was in the envelope he gave you?" Garrett's face darkened.
"Just personal stuff."
"Nothing about Calavera?"
"No."
"You tell me if it was."
"Hey, little bro, it's cool. Alex will be back. The power came back on. Alex must have done that."
I wasn't so sure. The generator seemed about as predictable as the storm tonight. I also noticed that Garrett hadn't answered my question. "When you told me Alex was having some problems, even before this weekend, what did you mean?" Garrett folded the bottom of his Hawaiian shirt like he was rolling a joint.
"Money problems. The hotel wasn't keeping afloat too well. Maybe there was more, I don't know. He said he and Chris..."
"Were arguing," I supplied.
"Yeah, but don't get ideas, little bro. It doesn't mean anything. You know Alex couldn't hurt a soul."
I remembered Alex's steely look the afternoon he pushed me out of the boat into the water with the blood and the sharks. I wasn't sure Garrett was being completely honest. I wanted to know what Alex had given him in that envelope, but I also knew my brother well enough to know I couldn't force the issue. He'd tell me only when he was ready. "You guys get some sleep," I told them. "I'll keep watch." Maya closed her eyes without protest.
"Wake me if somebody else dies."
Garrett looked over at Lane. "Go ahead," I said. "She could use some comfort." He studied me, like he was trying to detect sarcasm, but he didn't look too hard, or maybe he just didn't care.
"Good night, then," he said. "And you watch. Alex is going to prove you wrong."
I'm not sure when I fell asleep. I must have been too exhausted to even notice I was fading. I dreamed I was teaching a class at UTSA. We were discussing the pearl, talking about grief and the death of children. It was raining in the classroom. The students were trying to take notes, but their laptops and legal pads were getting soaked. Lindy's daughter, Rachel, was one of the students. Ty, Markey, and Chase were there. So was Imelda, holding a baby in either arm. Ralph Arguello sat in the back of the room, a beach umbrella over his desk. He kept grinning at me like he found my lecture amusing. I talked about the Black Plague and medieval parenthood. I discussed the sociological theory that parents in the Middle Ages, who were so accustomed to loss, didn't have the same emotional attachment to children as modern parents. Personally, I didn't buy that.
"Why not, Vato?"
Ralph asked.
"Just because death was more commonplace," I said, "doesn't mean life was cheaper."
Ralph smiled.
"I love this guy. He thinks he's a professor."
The students shifted uncomfortably in their seats. Rachel Brassus and Imelda and Ty were all watching me intently. Rain pattered against their papers. I looked down at the podium. My lecture notes had disappeared.
The
intense emotion in The Pearl.
People don't change, Ralph interrupted. They let grief tear them up. That's what you're saying, huh?
Well, yes,
and you had to look in a book for that, Vato,
Ralph laughed.
Why don't you look around?
Trace, Maya was shaking my arm. The water. I sat up groggily. Your water broke? No, look. I might have still been dreaming. The carpet was spongy with salt water. Garrett was rolling around in his chair, waking people up. His wheels made strange, squishy sounds.
Hey, get up! He shook Mr. Lindy, who was slumped in the armchair. Your shoes are wet!
Lane paced nervously, a blanket wrapped around her like a queen's robe. Chase and Markey were stirring on the floor. Their clothes were drenched.
What the hell? Chase said.
Water flowed down the steps into the parlor. The hall looked like a wood-paneled storm drain. The storm was still roaring outside, but louder now, like the waves were right against the building. I got up and helped Maya to her feet. Imelda ran in from the kitchen.
The basement is flooding the senor's body.
We can't worry about that, Maya said, trying to sound calm. We need to get out of this room. Imelda, I said, help me with Mrs. Navarre. The maid seemed glad to have something to do. She took Maya's other arm, and together we walked toward the stairs.
Look how fast the water's coming in.
Lane's face was ashen.
Where are we supposed to go?
Up, I told her. The second floor.
And if that floods?
Garrett and I exchanged looks.
Come on, darling, he told Lane. We've made it this far. Everything's gonna be fine.
He wheeled himself to the steps. Several inches of water were swirling in the foyer, racing down the hallway.
I don't swim too well, little bro.
You won't have to, I promised. Leave the chair. Let's go. He nodded uneasily, then slipped out of his wheelchair and hand-walked up the steps. As he navigated the hall, his torso in the water, he looked like a man wading up a deep, unfriendly river. Getting Maya upstairs wasn't easy. The stairs creaked and groaned. Below us, the first floor sounded like a public swimming pool, water sloshing everywhere. It was possible the whole hotel would get washed away. I knew that. But I didn't see any alternative other than getting into the middle of the building and hoping it didn't happen. We settled everyone in a row of guest rooms on the second floor. Imelda bustled around, making sure we all had enough sheets and flashlights. I figured the generator would go out again any moment, but strangely, the power stayed on. Maya got comfortable on one twin bed while Garrett and Lane collapsed on the other. I fiddled with the nightstand radio and, to my surprise, found a garbled AM station. 3:20 AM, and the tail end of the storm was coming ashore. Winds of 130 miles an hour. Massive flooding from Port Lavaca to Port Isabel. 15-foot waves. On the bright side, the rainfall should lessen by midday. The Spurs were playing tonight in Game 7 of the playoffs. Anyone who was still alive would have something to look forward to. There was shouting in the room next to us. It sounded like Ty, Markey, and Chase had gotten a second wind, and Mr. Lindy was trying to referee. I decided not to interfere. They probably needed the exercise. Head count. Maya seemed all right for the moment. Garrett and Lane were fine. The three college guys and Benjamin Lindy were next door. Alex, I said, did he ever come back?
Haven't seen him, Garrett admitted. I thought for sure.
He didn't finish. Even he looked worried. I thought about Ralph Arguello, grinning in the raining classroom.
Maybe you should just look around, Vato.
Imelda, I called. She came to the doorway, her arms full of towels. Have you seen Alex Huff? I asked.
No, senor.
Where's his bedroom? She looked down, hugging the towels to her chest.
Mr. Huff is very private about his room, senor.
I need you to show me. Jose appeared next to her, breathing hard. His pants were wet from the knees down.
¿Qué pasa?
He asked his wife.
He He wants to see Senor Huff's room.
Jose frowned.
We will show him, then.
I'll go, too, Garrett said. No, I said. Stay here. Take care of Lane and Maya. Garrett didn't look pleased, but the fact that I'd included Lane made it difficult for him to say no. Lane was curled on the bed, staring forlornly at the wall, as if it would blow apart any moment.
All right, Garrett said, but little bro, nothing crazy, okay?
On a night like tonight? Of course not. Nothing crazy at all. Alex's room was just down the hall on the left. The door was locked, which was a first. I started to think nobody at the hotel ever locked doors.
Alex! I yelled.
No answer. The noise of the storm was louder on this end of the hall. It almost sounded like it was inside his room. I pounded on the door. Still nothing. Imelda stood next to me, twisting her apron. Jose's body was turned away from me, like he was trying to evade me, though I wasn't sure why. It seemed odd that just a few hours ago I'd thought of him as a man with a perpetual smile. That smile was long gone.
You have a key? I asked them.
Imelda's eyes widened.
Senor Huff is the owner. He told us never to enter without permission.
You don't clean his room?
Never.
But you have to have a master key.
I... back downstairs,
Imelda said. Downstairs. She nodded half-heartedly. I looked at Jose.
You?
No, senor.
I'm just the cook. I have no master key.
Fine, I said. I'll break down the door. Jose tensed. Imelda started to say,
Senor!
I put my shoulder to the door and smashed it open. Inside, the room was a wreck. The window had been demolished, but the wood splinters and glass shards pointed toward the storm, as if something had been hurled out. A strip of torn red cloth fluttered from one jagged tooth of glass. The curtain was sprinkled with pink spots, like diluted blood. I tried to come up with some other explanation, but I kept coming back to the same conclusion. Someone had been pushed out the second-story window, and whoever it was had been wearing a shirt the same color as Alex Huff's. Chapter 26 Maya couldn't sleep. The pangs had passed, but they'd scared her worse than she'd let on. She lay on her side, trying to keep still. Lane Sanford was also awake. She was curled in the other bed, with Garrett sitting at her feet.
"We used to have storms at the ranch," Lane said. "Once lightning hit a tree, and it burned almost an acre. But I've never seen anything like this."
"Your family ranch?" Maya asked.
"No. Bobby rented the place."
Lane spoke his name like a cuss word she trained herself to say, a word proper ladies weren't supposed to know.
"You should get a restraining order," Maya said. "I'd be happy to help."
"I can't," Lane said. "Thank you."
Her tone was final. There was a secret there she wasn't ready to share yet. Abuse, probably. Something else, too. Something Lane thought she couldn't bring to the police. The problem with working criminal cases so long, Maya could come up with a whole array of depressing possibilities, all equally plausible and horrible. And yet she could still be surprised. The worst violence, the most awful forms of depravity, always happened in a so-called loving relationship. At least that made it easier for her to count her blessings. Whatever faults Trace had, however much he tortured himself with guilt or wrestled with his own demons, he was kind. He was a good man. He'd make a good father. Maya had no doubt whatever happened with the baby. She depended on that. She counted on him so much it scared her. And she tried to tell herself Trace would be safe. They would make it through this weekend. The storm rumbled overhead like an endless train. Noises from the other rooms eventually died down. Lane closed her eyes and began breathing deeply. Garrett stayed at his post at the foot of her bed, his hand protectively on her ankle.
Maya studied Garrett's face, looking for similarities to Trace. The hawkish nose and green eyes were the same. Garrett hid his chin behind a scraggly beard, but she imagined it was the same as Trace's, a strong jawline hinting at stubbornness. Time had not been as kind to Garrett, though. He was the same age as Maya. She remembered they had talked about that when they first met, how both of them were just turning 40. His complexion had turned sallow from too many years of hard drinking. His eyes were constantly bloodshot. His hair was frosted with gray. But he was still handsome in an unkempt way. He looked at her and smiled, and Maya couldn't help feeling a little better.
"You doing all right, darling?" he asked.
"Worried about Trace."
"Oh, hell, he'll be fine. That bastard'll drive you crazy if you keep worrying about him."
"You have a point.
I've known him longer, darling. I just hope that baby gets some of your good looks."
"He'll be beautiful, I'm sure."
"He?"
"The last few days, I've started to think of the baby as a he."
"A nephew to corrupt. I could handle that. Uncle Garrett."
Maya pictured Garrett with a baby in his lap, the two of them taking joy rides in the wheelchair. The baby would be wearing a tie-dyed jumper, a miniature Jimmy Buffett hat. "Did you ever think about getting married?" He glanced down at Lane.
"I'm not exactly an attractive package, in case you hadn't noticed. Kind of an extreme fixer-upper."
"Don't sell yourself short.
You're telling this to a man without legs?"
"You know I didn't mean it that way." Footsteps in the hall. Maya hoped it was Trace coming back, but it was only Mr. Lindy and the college boy, Ty. Ty was clutching his stomach as if he were sick, and Mr. Lindy was helping him walk. They didn't look inside the room as they passed.
"Maya, you're lucky," Garrett told her.